How you doing, mate? All right?
Yeah.
I was just trying to cover my bald spots.
That'd be good, fucking, you know. When you start washing your face, you end up having a bath, for Christ's sake.
This is episode 13, led by me, Johnny Morgan, Kay Alexander, and the legendary that is the Mad Scotsman, the one and only Sam Torrance. Nice to have you, buddy.
Oh, great to be here, Johnny. I'll do end for you, old pal.
Oh, mate, it's been nice strolling the fairways. Are you missing it at the moment, my friend?
No, I've been out. I've been out. I'm trying. I've retired years ago. But I still love the game, but I'm so bad that I've stopped playing for a long time. But in the last sort of 6 months, I'm trying to get back. I've got love, and love's there, but the capabilities are a long way apart. They're just a way, way in the distance. But I may have found some. Keep trying.
Well, a senior in your net, that seems like it's had better days. Looks like it's been worn and tattered.
I showed you a picture now. You see, that was a net within a net.
What was it?
Another net behind that net. And said net with the, has quite a few descriptions, like an old pair of underpants or whatever, which it probably did look like. That's all gone now, and it looks magnificent.
Does it? Well, you look like you were ripping.
There's only one layer now, John, you see, and you know the power I used to have.
You
know, one layer might be enough now.
It might be enough. Daniel, you look like you were clearing yourself nicely out the way.
Yeah, the clearance was good. Yeah, I lost something which I've remembered.
What was that?
Start of the downswing. I've got some great. My dad's book, Room at the Top, is a fantastic golf book, and I keep going back to him, and because he's gone now, but there's a picture of me with a 3-iron, just 2 feet from the ball, and the club's almost pointing skywards. I mean, it's so late, it's magnificent. And yeah. I never thought in those days, how do I get the club head back to square from there? For Christ's sake, it's nearly impossible. It can't happen. That's where my head went. Because I was never technically minded when I played. I only did as my dad told me. I never asked him why. Of course, even when he was still here, I got technical. I think you get technical as you get older. When you start to wonder why it's gone so bad or gone so good or whatever. But one of his biggest tips was from the top of the swing, it's like pulling the toilet chain down, left hand, it butt the club into the back of the ball, which is magnificent and clear. It's so simple, so simple. But I'd lost that because I've been trying to get the club head back to square. My dad would turn his grave if he saw two of the top 5 players in the world with the positions at the top of the swing. I mean, Dustin Johnson. Well, DeChambeau, I don't think he's quite as shut as him, but they're just incredible. I mean, I'd actually love to see my dad to see where they've developed the game from, because it looks so simple. Dustin Johnson at the top of the swing. I mean, his left wrist so bored and so shut, and the club face points straight at the sky, but then he never moves. The wrist never moves on the way down. And he just turns through and you watch it from 3 feet from the ball. It's extraordinary. It's so square and just going right up the bottom or the back side of the ball. And DeChambeau's even better. There was a couple of swings of him. What he's developed is just beyond belief. I mean, Gary Player talked years ago about the long drivers. You know, in 2-3 years we'll have guys driving at 450 yards. He wasn't far wrong, was he?
No.
He wasn't far wrong, and it's there. But DeChambeau's swing, I have to be honest, I've never seen anything like it. It's as good as I've ever seen. Just very, very, very lately. Not in the past, you know, he's worked, but he's got what a mind, what a developer. And he just works so hard. Wow. I backed him to win the Masters.
Did you?
As soon as I saw him, as soon as I saw this, when he came out like Tarzan or whoever, he was in on. I mean, but the swing, but he can draw it.
Yeah, he can.
None of them. None of the top, well, Rory definitely can draw it.
Definitely.
Naturally. But none of them, they're all hold-off faders, but so powerful. But he can draw it and still hit it 350, 360. Have you gone through Augusta? Not what he'll do to that course.
I know.
I can't wait. And it's coming. And we're going to have two of them in 4 months.
Yeah, but Sam, he says he wants to get like to 250 pounds, which is a hefty weight. And he wants to hit it further and have a 48 inch driver. I mean, how far is he going to bloody hit it?
But I saw a huge, I mean, I thought the setup at the Ryder Cup in France was magnificent for these bombers. I thought that was the way forward to take away from the, as they call it, the driving gouge now, the bombing gouge, which, to be honest, at Wing Fu, they were right. It's the first time I've ever seen the other side of the coin. Now you get your Kevin Kisners and these boys in the middle of every fairway, and you miss a fairway by a yard. I mean, if they're laying up, miss a fairway, they're going to have a 5-6 iron out of that jungle. Whereas bombing it up there, and he's hitting a lot of fairways. It was above average, Wing Fu. It was magnificent. It was magnificent.
Do you think that all-out power game is good for golf, Sam? You'll have seen it evolve, the technology, the course setups, the players themselves over the years. It seems power is more and more being rewarded. Is that good, or do we need more artistry back in the game?
This is artistry. This is artistry that we've never seen before. With a pencil in your hand, you've got these long drives, and we do a game of wedge, you know, it's the old gorilla story. A 3-foot putt and he hits it 300 yards. No, it's these boys can play and they can hit it that distance. No, full plaudits from me. I think it's magnificent. I mean, who didn't want to hit it further, whoever you are, from a 10 handicapper to a plus four or a pro, who doesn't want to hit it further and kill courses? I mean, that's what it's about. That's what it's about. I think it's fantastic. And, you know, the talk about changing the ball and changing whatever to bring them back. I mean, there's so much money going into productivity and development in these areas. You can hardly ask them to turn it down. I don't think it should turn it down. But we're losing so many great courses. I mean, there's other sides of the coin where it hurts. It really hurts to think of St Andrews. Oh my God, I can't imagine the play DeChambeau on a flat calm day around St Andrews. You know, it's just extraordinary because it's been one of the greatest courses to play forever. It's just another side of the coin. But, you know, in golfing terms, as a player my whole life, I love it. I think it's great. I'd love to be able to do it, but it's not going to happen.
It gets you all excited, doesn't it? Because I remember watching you way back when in one of your many Ryder amazing cups that you've played and seeing the shots, persimmon headed clubs, soft bladder balls, shaping it, working it, ball flights couldn't be high, they're always pretty low and everything like that. And then you see this man who's just hitting it up his left nostril, carrying it 350 plus, just bringing every golf course he takes on to its knees, possibly.
Well, as long ago as Medina, Ryder Cup, which was magnificent.
It was.
Wow.
Wow.
But I was commentating that week and I went out on a practice day and I stood in a tee and I watched these guys drive. And it's a long time ago, really, you know, compared to where we are right now.
Yeah.
And it was astonishing. McElroy, his drives, it almost had a second wind halfway in flight. But to watch it now, I mean, for people who just watch TV on golf, golf on TV, sorry. That'd be a good program, TV on.
That'd be good.
But it's just a joy to watch. Just a joy to watch. I mean, it's just phenomenal things. And what can you do about it?
Well, this is it. And
you know,
we had Tiger proofing of courses. Are we now going to get Bryson proofing of courses if he does take Augusta apart this November? Who knows how he's going to play it? But as you say, with a draw and how he hits it, there could be some seriously low numbers. What would Augusta do for then next April?
Well, there's others too. There's Wolfie, you know, there's a lot of them. I felt a wee bit sorry for Wolf at the US Open because with Morikawa winning the PGA, when Morikawa won, when Wolfie won his first event, he beat Morikawa in the last hole. par five. He made four, he didn't, and he won, and Morikawa was second. Then Morikawa went on to win the major. And then the two of them were, I thought he might have gone on and win it, but you couldn't take it away from DeChambeau. You couldn't even get close.
I got to ask you a question.
No, it was never close.
I got to ask you a question, Sam. You've played probably quite a lot of US Opens. What's been the hardest golf course you've ever gone to on a US Open, and why?
I only played about three, I think. I always thought they were the best test.
Yeah.
Apart from the British, the Open.
Yeah, exactly.
The best test, the fairest test, mm-hmm. I always thought was the US Open. Always set up fantastically. If you hit a bad shot, you were punished. Mm-hmm. The hardest one I ever played, it's difficult to say. Probably wasn't even the US Open. In America, hardest course I would know. Pinehurst was magnificent.
Yeah.
But then when I went back there, I hated it. got the runoffs, and it wasn't Pinehurst 2 that I remembered.
Oh, yeah.
I played that in the World Open, and it was 8 rounds. I thought it was the greatest course I'd ever played. I'd never seen anything like it. And for fun, I'll be short. So we can do wee stories, Gavin. Can we digress slightly?
Yeah.
Not allowed. So I'm playing in this World Open. It's 8 rounds. And it's delayed for frost for 3 hours. So I'm like second off. So I've got three of the dugs here, but it's a shame you can't see them.
Yeah. Four
I've got. But it's delayed up 3-4 hours. So I eventually got on the course, and the first year it's like badoing down the fairway. I shot 75, and I thought I just couldn't have been a shot better. Couldn't have been better. Come in. I'm third or fourth out, and I look at the score and see the scores. Gibby Gilbert, 62. 62, round Pinehurst. But that was a wee digression. Oh, I couldn't believe it. I thought, I need to find another game.
All digressions welcome here, Sam. I mean, I was doing my research, obviously, before chatting to you. And, I mean, where to even start with doing an interview with you and talking to you about golf, the longevity of your career, everything you've achieved. But
my interviews are very short compared to my career, so you better hurry up. Just kidding.
But, I mean, looking back on it, what are your fondest memories? Is it the Ryder Cups? Is it the 21 European Tour win?
No question, Ryder Cup.
Are there moments?
It was the captaincy. Beyond anything, a million miles.
What are your overriding memories of captaining the Ryder Cup at the Belfry, and how that
riding, how long's this interview? I can tell you from any part of it to the end of it. I mean, it was delayed a year, as this the Boris captaincy is going to be. My team was not in great shape a year later. But we had a huge heart, we had a great team, we had a great spirit. I just remember everyone being fantastic. And out of the shadows come the heroes, Philip Price. Tell him who I beat. Do you know that story?
You've got to tell it again, Sam. Sunday for anyone night. That doesn't, it's brilliant.
It's Sunday night. It's all over with one. Lee Westwood's been finding players and getting them into the bar at the Belfry, which is just log jammed. You just cannot move. How many people in there? I have no idea. However, he gets a hold of Suzanne and I. So we go down into the main bar. Don't know what time it is. No idea. It's well on. The place is jumping. And he's been leading people up onto the couch and then announcing them to the crowd, like the American wrestler, you know, the boy where he starts the I can't remember his name. Yeah. And so he announces Suzanne, and up she gets, and they go absolutely wild. Then they announce me and I go, same job. And then along comes Philip Price. They've got him, he's up next. And as he's climbing onto the seat, he's banging Westman on the arse and shouting, "Tell him who I beat! Tell him who I beat!" Because he beat Phil Mickelson. Extraordinary. Shot your head in the sixth.
Oh.
1 foot in the hazard. Mickelson's hit it to 3 feet. Mm-hmm. He's in the hazard. 1 foot in the hazard. He's even 60 yards right of the green. Hoops it round to 6 feet, holds it, and Mickelson misses.
Wow. He was renowned for that as well, wasn't he?
Yeah. Wow. I think the walk from the last green, mm-hmm. you've got me in a bad subject here.
Good subject. You played in eight yourself as well. You hold a winning Ryder Cup putt as well. How much have you seen it change as a
content? I've got to tell the end of that. Just the missus and I can back up to the room. From the last screen.
How much have you seen the Ryder Cup change through the years? I mean, it must be a very different beast now than what it was in the early years, and seeing Europe come into the fray as well.
Well, it all changed with Europe coming in the 79, humongously. It's certainly, television-wise, it's much bigger. Watching-wise, it's much bigger. I don't know, watching-wise, I'm sure in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, the viewing figures were not if they were able to see it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's always been, I think, the best golfing event there is. From as far back as I can remember to Tony Jacklin and Jack Nicklaus, the infamous, you know.
The concede, yeah.
And the Welsh, not, I know you're not Welsh. You know who I'm looking at, don't you? Brian Huggett hold the putt on 17, thinking he'd won the Ryder Cup in that Jacklin 69 match. That was a great moment.
But you've played alongside greats of the game. Obviously, you're a great of the game yourself. Who are your favourite teammates in that Ryder Cup situation?
Which situation? In the bar?
In the bar.
In the bar, yeah.
In the Sunday night. Woozy.
I can imagine.
Howard Clark, he was only great in the back because he didn't have to buy at the Ryder Cup. What a player he was.
Cool. Some iron player, wasn't he?
He was my favourite partner, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah, I always said that.
What made him stand out as a partner for you?
He never let you down. Mm-hmm. Just right there.
And obviously, Seve intertwined with the Ryder Cup. You'll have had a first-hand seat to all of that.
Seve was the king. He would do anything, you know, for the team.
Have you got a favourite Seve story?
Well, in the early days, they were so much more proficient out of the thick rough around the greens. And Seve was a genius at anything. And if you, at the Ryder Cup, this was one of the greatest advantages of a lesser player like me being in there with these legends and being able to ask them, you know, for information or for help. Mm-hmm. And Seve would just around anything. So this rough, I struggled out this rough at first. Basically, it was a bunker shot you had to play, but I didn't know that. So I asked Seve, can you help me? Of course. And down to the chipping green, he spent hours with you, whatever. Just fantastic. Mm-hmm. Just fantastic. But then, I think it was 2 weeks later, I'm in the Spanish Open, one of them, I'm in this side of the chipping green, hitting this stuff out, the thick stuff. And Seve walked by. And, Seve, please. Please, just come here. I'm still struggling with this. And he looked at me and said, Sam, I'll see you in 2 years, eh? Fuck off. That was one of the great things about being in the Ryder Cup team. Was being able to speak to these great players and glean information from them, you know.
Bloody brilliant, Sam. Absolutely brilliant, mate. I mean, I got to ask you a question. Do you ever get tempted, I know later on in your career now, and you're not playing golf, do you ever fancy getting your dad's book out and heading out towards the European Tour and start coaching some of these young kids and giving them the words of wisdom your dad give to you and you don't mind giving to them? Do you ever get tempted?
Matt Southgate, I love Matt, great kid, really can play, and he asked me to help him, and I would love to help him, one, I'm not, I mean, I couldn't teach Daniel, my son, which broke me. I only ever did what I was told. I didn't learn the ins and outs of the swing wave, although I'm getting there now. I do know a lot more about it now. But I lost the thread there with that.
You're all good.
Not go on the tour yet. No, because I couldn't walk around the course and just give justice to what I was trying to do. I'm not a coach, but on the phone, help you out, do whatever you like. But no, I mean, I have the book right there. The book's on right over there, right now, open on a page. At the start of the downswing, I refer to it all the time. It's one of the best books, all golfing books, I think, of all time. Room at the top. It's all sold out. But
what was the best bit of advice your father, Bob, ever gave you?
Best bit of advice my dad ever gave me.
It doesn't have to even be golfing, actually. It can be anything.
It's all good.
That's a tricky one. Every single bit of information he gave me was as important as the other, because he had a wonderful eye from the game. Mm-hmm. He never, you know, if the club face is shut at the top, he told you why. He showed you where it came from. But of course, club face shut at the top. I want an example to make with the top two on the wall. But I think my dad, just effort, mm-hmm. practice.
Yeah.
You know, just work. I mean, I hate practicing. I did. I like it now, funny enough. And we used to have such an argument, because one of his greatest sayings was, if you don't take it with you, you won't find it there. Mm-hmm. Which was so true to me. And I stuck to that my whole life. Because when I finished in a golf, if I finished in a round, mm-hmm. I mean, 47 years I did out there, main tour and senior tour, 46, 7 years. Mm-hmm. And you would not see me at the course after I finished. I'd be gone, back to my room, or out in the movies, or just doing whatever. Mm-hmm. And my dad, meaning, when he said that, if you don't take it with you, you won't find it there, you have to do your work at home, which I did all the time. I worked my wee arse off at home, like you wouldn't believe. But of course, then he started to get more pupils and do more, and then he came on tour. End of Thursday, first round. Let's go to the range. I said, what for, Dad? Well, you need to work. I said, but Dad, I didn't bring it here. I'm not going to find it here. Why would I go and work? Oh, the arguments we had about that. But I was right. I think I was right.
Yeah.
I had a lot of practice. The East is known. You know, that's what suited me. I don't think you'd have saw Monty there. But he was the same, I think. Yeah, it was about playing the game and doing your work at home and coming with a free mind, not being on the first team. Just go play golf. Yeah. That's a key to great golf. It's just playing golf. I mean, if you get some of the moderate players in the world, just put them out in the Monday morning and see how they play at the home club, you think, Jesus, how good is this kid? And then it changes, and you go on at tournaments. It's you have to be, I think, relaxed and know what you're doing and enjoy what you're doing when you're there.
You mentioned the number of years you were on tour there. What do you think was the key to your longevity and being able to play at the game for so long? Sorry, what was that?
No, I loved the game. I loved to play. Hang on, I need to shut this window. It's freezing. No, I love to play. I mean, my first 10 years on tour, 10 years on tour, I missed two events. Mm-hmm. And that was because I had a broken toe and I couldn't play in them. Mm-hmm. And every year I go to South Africa, East Africa, the Far East in the January, and then back on tour. We didn't play before we didn't play before the Masters. We didn't play before April. So we did all that traveling. And I did it every year for forever. And I loved it. And my hobby was golf. And I came home, I'd go and play at Sunningdale 3-4 times a week. Bit of cash, bit of fun, bit of banter. I just loved it. And the longevity comes from my father, installing, working swing.
Sam, we were talking about the travel, and you mentioned that it was more fun back in the day. What well, made
it was more fun? It was easier. It was easier. Airports were easier. Everything was easier. The security was easier. But now, you know, it has to be the way it is. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the way it is today. I just think it's harder to travel. Mm-hmm. Even more so right now. But, you know, so even 10, 15 years ago, it started to get tedious. You know, it used to be a laugh going into the airport, a few beers, chat away, and blah, go on the plane and go. But
you went to some incredible places in days before people were traveling there for holidays a lot of the time as well. Did you ever get yourself into any interesting scrapes while you were on your travels that you needed to get yourself out of?
I once spent 2 days in Nigeria in a taxi. Went across country when there was a queue on. And if you weren't indoors at 6 o'clock at night, you were shot.
Ooh.
Then and then you want to be a bit stronger than that. You want a description.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, a bit stronger than that.
Full story on that. That sounds like there's so much more to it.
In those early years, we used to play Nigeria, East Africa, West Africa, Nigeria, Kenya, and Zambia. So when you went to the Nigerian Open, they used to get you there Thursday the week before. And they would split you up into four and send you around the country to pro-arms. So we went to Ibadan. it wouldn't be digressing to tell you what I was thinking, but I won't tell you what I was thinking. It was quite funny, but I'm not sure.
Have been some funny shit, Sam, that you're thinking of just there. Don't worry about it.
A grin on your face then was a picture.
So they split us up. So you go there and you play the 2 day program. But as we were there, there was a coup in Lagos, and everything closed down. We were the only ones that were outside sort of driving distance to get to it. All the other three programs were Port Harcourt. I can't remember the other company names. They were right next to. Lagos, the capital. Yeah. So we were kind of stuck, and 2 days on, we're like, we've got to go. You know, if we don't go, we're not going to make it. You know, everyone else is going to get there because they're just half an hour up the road. So David Chillis, a Scottish golfer, myself, and a Swedish reporter hired a taxi to take us back to Lagos.
Yeah.
So off we went, and the journey was extraordinary. I mean, we literally, it was fantastic fun, it was exciting, it was wow, you know, these mud hut villages, and we had gone through a mud hut village, and the taxi driver tapped a cyclist by accident, and he went over, and the next thing, there's 200 chanting African gentlemen around the taxi, and I'm laughing away, smiling, so is David Chillis. And we looked at the driver, and he had turned white, and he wasn't actually white, so this was the problem. And he just, woof, off we went. We got out of that, and so off we went. Yeah. But we had to get into a hotel, so we had it chartered, and it was brilliant. I think we had two stops, one overnight stop. And then eventually, we get back to Lagos. Mm-hmm. And all the others who had been in Port Harcourt, maybe don't know how long after we had left, the curfew lifted and the airports opened, and they all flew back to Lagos and got there 20 minutes before us. So we've arrived in this ramshackled old taxi covered in dust and that. But that was a hell of a journey to get there. We got there in the end. And that was exciting, you'd have to say.
How did you play that one?
I loved it there. Lagos was just the best. Just sand and oil greens. You have never seen anything like it. Just magnificent. Everything is dead straight. All the greens are made of sand and oil. But if you, in proper tournaments too, Brian Barnsley won it, and some good players played there. Sandy Lyle won it. And you had a sweeper. There was a sweeper at every green. So when one group finished, the guy came out and started at the hole and did a circle run and run and run until he'd finished the green. Then you hit your approaches in and point, and everything was dead straight. But by the end of the day, because of the sweeping, a lot of sand goes in the hole. And you kind of get back out and patch it up. You know, it's just not going to happen. So yeah. You've been late in the day, you can miss the hole by that much, pin high, as long as it was dead weight and it just zoom, fell in. But conversely, if you get the one that the rim, that was one, the rim actually sticks up and you can get a part that's right in the middle, quite so, and it'll hit the rim, come straight back towards you. And there's nothing you can do about it, it's just the way it was. But I enjoyed playing it, it was the hottest, sweatiest place I ever played. I played India, I played in a lot and a bit. In Lagos, between the car, the house, coming out of the house where you're staying in, and get to the car 20 yards, you may as well have walked through a shower. You were just drenched. Yeah. In sweat. It was that hot. And they used to have there's a swimming pool at the Akoya Club. And it was just, oh. As soon as you come off the last green, everybody went there.
Right,
into the pool and chilled off.
I got to ask you a question as well, though, Sam. Can I just take you back? What's been the most special round of golf you've ever played? And where was it? And who was it with?
That's tricky. There's different meanings. To win tournaments or to score the lowest score you ever scored. And the lowest score I ever scored is... it was actually ridiculous. It was a pro-am at Bathgate. It was the centenary pro-am.
Yeah.
I flew up with Bernie Gallagher, who's been a dear friend my whole life, and Ronnie Corbett and Bruce Forsyth.
Oh.
I up together. We're all playing. I'm playing with Ronnie on the day. It was what a gentleman. What a lovely, lovely man. And we're delayed. Whatever. We're flying up on the day we're playing. And we arrive at the course at, say, 11:45, and we're on the tee at 12:30. Yeah. There's just no time to go and hit balls. There just isn't. So I go in and I've had 3 pints of Guinness. And come out on the first tee, two clubs, as you know, Johnny Boy, two clubs.
Yeah,
two clubs. First hole's driving a 5-iron to 10 feet, and I missed it for eagle. And I went on to shoot 58. 13 under par. Just extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. It was just beyond belief. And that was probably, it was definitely the best round I ever played. But the preparation, I tried to emulate it many times. But it never worked again.
Because the 3 pints of Guinness and no warm-up is an absolutely safe way.
Never worked again.
I'll give it a go.
Grab the twins and swing out.
What did
Irish Open, winning the Irish Open. First time at Port Marnock. They got me into the Ryder Cup for the first time in 81. That was one of the most special wins. Brown Port
Marnock. That's a great golf course.
Around there. And Royal Melbourne, the Australian PGA. That was pretty special, winning there.
Just wondering, when you shot that 58, and it was the prime, so were you playing with Ronnie Corbett and Bruce Forsyth? Were they with you?
No, just Ronnie, and it was actually Bernie's brother, Jim, who's sadly passed away recently. That was us, three of us.
What did Ronnie make of it, as you're absolutely tearing it up with him?
He didn't mention it quite a few times later when we met. No, he loved it. It was pretty special.
Yeah, I mean, you've been able to meet some incredible people through golf over the years. Aside from the golf people, if you like, are there any celebrities or other people that stand out for you as just wonderful people that you've been able to meet that without your career in golf, you wouldn't have been able to?
President Kaunda.
Where was he president of? I should know.
President. Michael Douglas.
Uh-huh.
Samuel Jackson, Sean Connery, what a ledge. I first think in those early days, I'm playing the Kenyan Open. This is God's honest truth. I must have been 18, 19, and I'm sitting in the hotel in Nairobi. It's the Kenyan Open, and I'm walking in, and who's walking towards me? It's Sean Connery. And he says, "Morning, Sam." almost shit myself. I didn't almost. I think I probably did.
Yeah, I would have.
Henry, 007, the greatest of all time, knew who I was. I mean, it was just beyond belief. And became my dad taught him. My dad taught him when he shot 69 at St Andrews and won the. I'm not sure which one it was. One of the big October medal or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
I don't know the real name for it, but yeah.
Go on, mate. Tell us a good woozy story. One day we'll get him on and he can tell us a story about you.
Playing heel to heel. Unfortunately, it was might not be the best story for him, but it was my fault. We were playing in Hong Kong. And the hotels they used to put us up in were just the most magnificent places, right in the bays and overlooking all of Hong Kong. And it was just magnificent. So we're in having breakfast. Remember Tuesday, you've got to remember when you're playing in Asia, you finish Sunday night and you go straight to the next place. So you're there Monday, you don't need to be there until at least Tuesday. So Mondays are sometimes a wee bit hectic. But so Tuesday morning, we're in for breakfast and I've ordered 2 boiled eggs. Hard. Hard boiled eggs. 6 minutes. 6 minutes. Who's just having what he's having? So off they go. 2 minutes later, out come my eggs. And I thought, this is a wee bit strange. I mean, you order 6 minute eggs and they come out in 2 minutes. It's just very strange, but it's very good to tell. So sitting there, chop it off, boom. It's just, I mean, it's virtually raw. Oh, come here.
Is this the duck? Oh, it's the dog.
That's Jinky. He's one of the four. This is my mum and dad's dog. I'm looking at.
Oh, mate, what a beauty. I love my dogs, mate. Love my dogs.
There you go. She likes to sit.
Oh, you can stay there. Go on.
So I've called the waiter up. Look, really? Not cooked. Not cooked at all. Really? Come on. 6 minutes. Hard.
Sort yourself out.
I mean, but these poor chaps, I mean, the Chinese, I'm Scottish. I mean, no wonder they don't understand me. But anyway, so it comes out the second time, it's exactly the same. And you're hungover, you just, and I just want my eggs. I just want my eggs. Jesus.
Yeah.
Friggin' eggs. For the third time, out they come. And they're the worst now. They might as well, they were actually virtually raw. So I've opened one and it just, and I've just lost it, blot. And I've lifted my hand up and I've smashed my hand down as hard as I can on top of these. One egg half open and one egg on the side, and it's gone whoosh all over Woozy. the plate glass windows, all this raw egg is running down the window. And I've just stood up, I've looked at Woozy, sorry, and just gone, just left him.
Egg on your face, Woozy. I
mean, what a companion, what a player, what a lad. You gotta get him on. He's a real good guy.
Yeah, we'd love to have him on, but that's for sure. I mean, Woozy, yourself, Faldo, you know, Lyle, Seve, all growing up. My inspiration was you lot. All of you lot. It was I can't say one was more exceptional than the other. It was just full-on inspirational, made me want to pick up a club and actually hit a ball for the first time. And it gave me the bug. And, you know, watching you guys on the box, didn't have enough money to go and watch you live. You know, so watching you on the TV, if my mum and dad would allow me. And, you know, there it was. You know, there you were. With the biggest heart, biggest smile, playing the best golf, wanting to be you, Sam. And just love you being on the show, mate. Thank you, mate.
No, not at all. But you got to, as a youngster, it was just, I was 17, 18, 1970, yeah. 72, and just let loose on the world. It was, there was nothing better. You know, just nothing better. I think I missed my first 8 cuts. And then the 9th one was the John Player Trophy. And I was leading with 9 holes to play.
Really?
Help! Yeah, I finished 9th in the end, but just the fun, you know, and the excitement of the tour, the development of the tour, the playing every week, making the cut, getting in the next week, or getting your card. I actually got my card first year and I never lost it after that. But it was just great. What life?
Amazing life, Sam. I'm just going to give you, see if you can give some words of advice to the youngsters coming through that get on the European tour, US tour, wherever they play, and they, you know, they go on a run of not making cuts. How did you get your mindset out of that and become the player you did? Was it team? Was it you? Was it, what was it?
Well, certainly a team. and my dad's phone call. I phone my dad every day, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, and went on tour every single day. I told him every shot I hit. Now that's proper love from your dad to my shite for 18 holes every single day. And he would always, and I don't know if I'm digressing from the question you asked me, he would always, whatever was wrong, whatever I was doing, if I said, you know, it's going right, it's going left, I'm hooking it, I'm in the fire, whatever, it'll be this or it'll be that. And the next morning you go, wow. That would that get me out there. But yeah, I did digress.
All digressions welcome here, Sam. John mentioned looking up to you. I wonder, who did you look up to when you were a young teenager?
Jack Nicklaus. He was the king. My dad was Hogan, but possibly sneakily Sam Snead. I don't think he ever let on how much he loved Sam Snead, but Hogan with his game. But Jack Nicklaus was beyond belief to me. I came out of the Open in Muirfield. It might have been 72, and the Tented Village was on the 17th of Muirfield, which is par 5. And I've come out of the tent and looked over the fence, and down there in the middle of the fairway, third shot, about 147, 150 yards, was Jack Nicklaus. Oh, I hear him. I watch him. And when he hit the shot, I've never forgot it to this day. I have never forgotten it to this day. It gave me an element to my game which carried me through my whole life. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like, it was just a three-quarter shot, was basically is what he played. He went up to his right shoulder and he came through to his left shoulder. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. Wow, what control. What, just to be able to do that in your game. And I loved that. But Nicklaus, I got to meet him. I got to play with him. I can tell you a Ryder Cup story about him, but the other story I'm going to tell you was I once asked him, and knowing him reasonably well and having played with him, and Jack, do you mind if I give you a compliment? And he knew I wasn't a referee. He knew it was a wee bit of a character. So he wasn't sure what was coming. He says, yes, yes, Sam, go on then. I said, well, Jack, in the 400 majors that I won in my dreams, you were runner-up every time.
Oh, what a great story.
He liked that. He liked that. Oh, what a man. Oh, what a man.
Oh, you mentioned the Ryder Cup story there.
Sorry, go on, Kit.
You mentioned you had a Ryder Cup story about him there as well. Can we be cheeky?
Well, it was 83 West Palm Beach, and it was a Tuesday night, I think. We were going to the yacht club, and we all had our cars. And it was 15 minutes away and given directions. And Fuzzy Zeller was outside and he was given directions to someone, one of the players. And we thought, well, we don't need directions. Let's just follow Fuzzy. So perfect. So we follow Fuzzy, Woozy, and we're off. And it's like 25 minutes later, we're not there yet. So Christ, and there's no traffic. So this, I thought it was 15 minutes, but this is a joke. So another 10 minutes, we eventually get there and drive up to this palatial looking place, just magnificent. And get out of the car, we walk around the car, and Calvin Peake gets out of the car in front, he rings the doorbell. Jack Nicklaus answers the door. Oh, Christ, that's unbelievable. Jack Nicklaus get to welcome us. Of course, it was Jack Nicklaus, and he wasn't welcoming us. He was welcoming the American team. But the American team were going to Jack Nicklaus's house for dinner, and the European team were going to the yacht club. So he brought Wesley and I in and gave us a drink and took us over to the big plate glass window, and he pointed across the lake to these lights of 3 miles away. He said, that's the yacht club, that's where you're meant to be.
Oh, I love it.
Going through his house, there was an army bit going through his house. I walked past it once, and then I stopped, and I just shook my head, and I turned around, and I came back sort of 3 feet, and there was this, sort of, from ceiling to floor, a glass cabinet, and it was just all medals. Oh, God.
My God.
You'd ever seen. Just ever. And it was just so kind of hidden, you know, it wasn't in your face, just Jack Nicklaus, though.
That's incredible. And to have been able to meet your hero like that and compete against him and with him and everything.
I saw him naked.
You saw him naked?
You seen him naked once. I seen you naked once as well, Sam.
In the locker room. In the locker room and on the Champions Tour. Things happen, isn't it? So I'm in the locker room just playing the Champions Tour, and I've changed my shoes and I'm coming round. Leave, and there in front of him is Jack Nicklaus with his towel over his shoulder and his wee bare arse walking in front of me. Still wanted to run in front of him and have a look, but I didn't because I'm sure I would have been disappointed there as well.
When you're Jack Nicklaus, you can walk through all locker rooms in golf clubs naked and no one's going to say a word. I love it.
Exactly.
I once saw Monty naked in a golf club changing room in Azerbaijan, but that's a different story entirely. But yeah, never see your heroes naked, I think, is probably
Moggy.
Story.
Moggy, yeah. You're looking at me.
Yeah,
that's like a world fair, that story, isn't it?
Sam, just before we let you go, it's been fantastic to have you on, but you're sat in what looks like a lovely office there. You're in a beautiful brown leather chair, and just in the background of our Zoom call, I can see some fantastic photos on the wall. Are they some of your greatest memories in golf? Just talk us through a couple of the things that we can see there.
Well, I'll tell you the whole lot. It's Suzanne and I have been here over 30 years, and where we are, the first thing you can do, the only thing you can do is add on, I think, a third of the original size of the house. And the first thing we did was, this was a snooker room. Mm-hmm. It's now a pool room, because it's more sociable. But it's a boys' room. We've got a bar, dartboard, pool, all my memorabilia, all the Ryder Cup bags are there. Evans in here.
That's my favourite.
I tell you what, if you let me in that room, I'd take a lot of money off you, Sam. I know it.
Margie.
Yeah.
What at?
Pools? All of it. Darts, pool, the lot.
I'll tell you what I'll do. As much as you want, pal. You see, that's a mistake, Margie. You should never challenge someone who has a table in his house.
Me too. I have one as well. And a dartboard.
I've got a cue here from Mike Massey.
Oh.
Who was in the Massey shop. Run the ball. Remember that?
Yeah.
I'll tell you another wee story. It's a quickie, but I'm playing the Masters at Augusta. I only played 3 times. What a place. What a course. What times. I mean, what a thrill. But we're not going there. So, it's Tuesday afternoon, I'm bored, I want to do something. So I look in the pool hall, perfect. So I go to this pool hall, it's Tuesday, a few beers, having a laugh, and then they find out I'm actually a contestant in the Masters. And it's like fucking ridiculous. They've just
got
bananas now. Like, no player has ever been in there, whatever. But that was just me, you know. I'd go to bars at home, have a few drinks and just relax and then leave. But the pool hall, so start playing. And of course, I'm pretty good. Then this guy challenges me. He says, I'll play one-handed.
What?
I'll play one-handed. Okay. He says, I won't play for money. I will not play for money. I could not. I mean, the guy, it was extraordinary. It was extraordinary. Really? As good as I've ever seen him playing pool one-handed. And he just did it one like that, De Niro, or like that. Yeah, oh, extraordinary.
Oh, my
really
God.
Kind, really kind to me. That was fun.
That's fun. Mate, you've got so many stories, mate. It's been a thrill having you on, boss.
Sam, I think we'll let you go now because our time's up.
Oh, you're boring, for Christ's sake.
No, mate. I want to go on forever.
As long as you're willing to sit here telling stories, I will listen all evening long, and I'm sure our listeners would love it as well.
Well, ask me one.
Okay. Here's an interesting one. We've talked about a lot of high moments and a lot of great things. Is there a low moment?
Oh, yes.
A moment of regret that stands out for you from your
career?
There's
a lot more low ones than there are ones.
Well,
1985. Mm-hmm. Dunhill Cup. 3 weeks, 4 weeks after the Belfry, which I'd hold the winning putt. Mm-hmm. Lucky me, very lucky me, changed my life. That's another story. But now it's Scotland, America.
Oh.
And I'm playing Curtis Strange.
Curtis Strange.
And it's first two matches. And those, it was the Dunhill Cup. So it was the three-man team from each country, which we used to love. Because you get another shot at the Americans as well.
I love that tournament.
So I'm playing Curtis. First two matches are one each. So it's between him and I. And we're on the last hole, St Andrews, Valley of Sin. Both reasonable tee shots. Wedges. He leaves it in the Valley of Sin. And I had it 10 feet short of the hole, putting up the green. It's his putt first. He comes up, leaves it 5 feet short. I'll finish. Yes. And I'm praying he misses it because I can definitely two-putt from there, I think. He knocks it in, which I thought was strange for him. Anyway, so he's knocked it in. So I've got this 12-footer to put Scotland in the final, in the semi-finals. A good putt, just a wee bit firm. Goes about 18 inches past, downhill left to right, normally. Missed it at left edge, missed. Oh. Scotland are out. And that was my low moment. That was one moment in my career I'd love to have again. But Curtis was my opposing captain in the Ryder Cup captaincy, so I forgive him.
Yeah, you got your own back.
You got your own back in the end.
Definitely. I love Curtis. He's been a great friend for forever. I've met Curtis in the early 70s, and his wife Sarah, a great couple, still great friends. And I was lucky to come up against someone as a captain who I really respect and admire, and we had a great time.
How many guys do you still keep in regular contact with these days from your days on tour?
It depends. Mm-hmm. I mean, I couldn't put a number on it, you know. It depends. Generally, kind of like New Year, you know, it's like 12:30, and you've had a wee dram, and then you have a few more, and then you start phoning your mates. Now, I do that frequently during the course of the year. I'll have a few drinks. You just start phoning your mates and see how they're doing, and especially recently in the COVID situation. I think if you think of someone, phone them or her. Well, maybe not. That might get you in trouble. But if you think of a mate or a mate's wife, you know, phone them. Peter Alice mm-hmm. is just an absolute legend. He took at least twice in the last 9-10 months, just phones up. Mm-hmm. All right, so I'm just checking in on my old mates, and it's so lovely. And I've called him back too, and it's something when I started out in 72, he used to write to me every time I won. He used to write a letter to me. And that meant so much. It instilled something in me of respect, I think. And he's a gentleman, Peter Alice.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You wore him on the telly. Yeah. He was the best. You remember when Paldo's coming up the last at Sunningdale, the European Open? And Andy Prodgers, that's my daughter in the other room there, by the way. What would you say then? Roger was marching ahead, and Peter Alice gave this description of what Andy Roger was thinking about. It's an absolute classic. A great man. Anyway, another digression.
Wonderful stuff, Sam. Well, I think that's a lovely note to finish on there, that we all do meet some wonderful people through golf, and especially at a time like this, with so much uncertainty. It's great to stay in touch with people, and I think if you think of someone, phone them, I think is a lovely bit of advice that we can all apply to our lives in general, frankly. So all I've got to say is thank you so much for coming on, Sam. It's been an utter pleasure to listen to your reminiscences and incredible stories from through the decades in golf. I know John loved it as well. John, how was that for you, just to sit here and take all that in?
Well, I've just been really fortunate over the last couple of years having Sam join the TV crew doing some commentary. He's not doing it at the moment, but I mean, just we got to rub shoulders again. I think the last time we met was around a poker table when he pulled my pants down and spanked the bottom blue on the poker table. But that was honestly, I think the last time
we really done that.
Yeah, I was chip leader for a while, but then he fought back. He had his shades on and soaked me out of it. So, yeah, it was really, really good. And I got to say, Sam, it's just lovely to have you, man. I feel very easy to phone you as well. You're just a lovely bloke. No, I can't wait to take you on around Sunningdale in your backyard.
I'll arrange that game just now. I'll get Mr. Henry. I'll see if he'll come and join us and maybe get him to do your podcast. He's a legend, Stephen Henry. He was one of my heroes.
Well, mate, I would love to have him on. Oh,
all right.
My goodness, yes. But love you, mate. Thank you, Sam.
Absolutely incredible from Sam Torrance there. Wonderful stories. If you enjoyed that listening at home half as much as John and I did here in conversation with Sam, I know you've had a great last hour or so. Thank you so much for listening to episode 13. Please remember, follow us at Twitter on @FilthyLipOut. Please like, share and review wherever you listen to this podcast so other people can find us. That is all we've got time for on episode 13 with Sam Torrance. But we will see you again next week.